Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and in this hour, you're going to hear familiar voices if you've been tuned to this listener-supported public radio station, new voices if you've just discovered us, members of our news team here at WEKU, with a variety of stories and interviews, reminders that this radio station still has real, live, local people getting out there to bring you news and information about your home region. The COVID-19 sickness gripping much of the state is playing out in our hometowns. WEKU's Corinne Boyer has paid a visit to mine, Moorhead, and found the hospital there knocked back on its heels.
At St. Clair Regional Medical Center, the second floor whirls with conversations of hospital staff passing each other in the hallway and talking as they enter the cafeteria. But away from this gathering spot where staff may get a bit of respite, there's a looming sense of somberness. Although you wouldn't know it by walking along the second floor, the hospital is dealing with a crisis.
We're like all of the hospitals in not only the Commonwealth, but the hotspots in the United States. We're just simply overrun with very, very acutely sick and critically ill patients who have COVID-19.
That's Donald Lloyd, president and CEO of St. Clair Regional Medical Center. On this particular morning, Lloyd says the hospital is at 140% capacity.
The majority, overwhelming majority of which are unvaccinated. And these patients are requiring extensive resources in order to keep them alive. And we have bed capacity issues. We have nursing capacity issues.
This isn't news. Hospital capacity in Kentucky has been pushed to its limits over the past several weeks. And like other hospitals, St. Clair is making concessions to handle an ever-growing number of patients. It's relying on assistance from the Kentucky National Guard. A tent providing COVID-19 treatment now sits in the parking lot. The medical staff is going as far as treating COVID-19 patients in their homes. Lloyd says teams of nurses, doctors, physician's assistants, and respiratory therapists check on patients twice a day.
We call it COVID care at home. And while those patients are acutely ill, we're providing oxygen therapy to them in their homes. We're monitoring their oxygen saturation. As of right now, we have 75 patients in that program.
Lloyd says that's on top of the 50 COVID-19 patients in the hospital. Just outside of Lloyd's office window is the parking lot that now hosts an additional 20 beds for patients receiving monoclonal antibody treatment, which has been one of the most effective treatments for COVID to date.
And we're providing this therapy to patients that are COVID positive, but are not critically ill yet where they require hospitalization. In the monoclonal therapies, is beneficial to them if we can get it into them early that will prevent hospitalization.
Down the hall, two members of the Kentucky National Guard sit in a small office. Major Michael Wayne is the commander of the COVID-19 response team at the hospital and oversees 15 soldiers. The National Guard assists with non-medical tasks. Wayne says they check in with the pharmacy every morning.
They usually have supplies that need to be unloaded and restocked at 11 a.m., so we do that every morning. And then we also check back in the evenings with the pharmacy to see what else they may need. We also man the entry points to the hospital, and we check temperatures of visitors. We do that every day.
Wayne says the team does whatever they can to help.
Anything we can do to alleviate the stress, you know, if you have to pull a nurse to go and unload supplies and stock supplies, if we can do that just to alleviate a little bit of stress or even just boost morale just by them seeing us here in the hospital, you know, it feels good because they've worked really hard for the last year and a half.
Donald Lloyd says the Kentucky National Guard's work has been invaluable. Temporary teams from the Federal Emergency Management Agency have also assisted the hospital. And while the assistance allows the hospital to treat COVID patients, the staff is exhausted. Lloyd says all hospital workers are on mandatory overtime. He doesn't think the sense of urgency is resonating in the surrounding community.
It would not appear that we are in the midst of a pandemic. People are not wearing masks. They're not social distancing. It is a different world outside the walls of any hospital right now.
In downtown Moorhead, people walk in and out of shops on Main Street with and without masks. Inside a bookstore, Moorhead State University junior Camille Vermillion says she's grateful for mask wearing on campus, but worries about the situation at St. Clair.
It worries me a lot. I'm also concerned because just picking up on conversations in public or on campus, there are still some people that I know are resistant to getting the vaccine, resistant to wearing masks.
Marie Rinchen lives in Fleming County. She used to work in the food service department of St. Clair. She worries about other hospitals filling up too. Her stepdad recently had trouble getting treatment for a medical condition.
So he went in, he was having a problem breathing and he was having some swelling in his throat, and he went to the emergency room because it was getting a little bit serious. And they were trying to refer him to a specialist, and they were having a really difficult time finding any place that could help him because all the hospitals, you know, locally and even a little bit farther out, they're all full with COVID patients.
Situations like Rinchen's may get worse before they get better. A few days later, during a COVID-19 update, Governor Andy Beshear warned that if hospitals collapse, communities will see more deaths.
Hospitals that are on the brink of collapse that end up full result in death, and more death than we should have. More death from people who will have COVID that might have made it, but more death from people that are hurting from something other than COVID.
Jeff Grubb retired from the local school system and works part-time at a brewery. At this point, he says he's angry about the situation at St. Clair's because it's caused by people who aren't vaccinated.
Unfortunately, it's become a political issue. And I'm angry at the people who aren't vaccinated because they're endangering. That's their choice, but they're endangering the lives of my grandkids who can't get vaccinated yet.
Vaccination numbers have slowly increased in the last couple of weeks. In mid-September, nearly 60% of the entire state's population had received at least one shot. Health experts say it's the only way to get the virus under control. Without more vaccinations, hospitals like St. Clair will continue to be bombarded with patients. Donald Lloyd again.
I never... in my entire career would have ever imagined I would see what I've seen. And look, I got the easy job. It's those nurses and doctors that take this stuff home. It's incredibly demoralizing for them because it's preventable.
I'm Corinne Boyer for WEKU's Eastern Standard.
Even before they met each other and married, the two people you're about to hear from were Kentucky artists and community arts organizers for 20 years. WEKU arts reporter Sherry Lawson talks with Dr. Rebecca Gail Howell, poetry editor of the Oxford American, and Brett Ratliff, recording artist and program director of Apple Shop's WMMT.
From a cozy room in their Lexington home, with their dogs Blue and Monk by their sides, Rebecca Gail Howell and Brett Ratliff talk about their lives and their art.
As art is an extension of both our lives, I think that it's unavoidable that we influence each other's work.
We're both artists, community arts organizers. The healing power of art for communities is really important to both of us.
Brett tells about his recently released solo album titled Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Whitesburg, Kentucky is a solo project that really did come out of the pandemic. And the title, Whitesburg, Kentucky, is just sort of a tribute to a place that has meant so much to me as a progressive artsy, you know, little beacon in East Kentucky.
While the album is a tribute to Whitesburg, it came about as Brett was processing a lot of grief. His 99-year-old grandfather died of COVID, and it was the reason Brett ended the album with this song.
I'm going home for my reward.
For my reward.
Away up there to see my Lord.
I recorded into my phone that track, I'm Going Home, and sent it to my aunt who was taking care of him. And she played the phone, basically voice message for him. And he came to for a moment and said, "That's Brett," and smiled, and then fell back asleep. And I'm not sure that he came to again after that.
With mother and dad,
with mother and dad.
The angels fair.
Rebecca Gale says her husband is a lot like his grandfather, who was affectionately known as Papaw.
Brett's Papaw was a very quiet, strong man of integrity. He had a deep kindness in him and sense of community that really is unlike anything else I've ever seen. And Brett has that in him.
She says it's part of what attracted her to Brett when they first met at Hindman Settlement School in 2015. Brett was program director at the school. Rebecca Gale was teaching poetry writing there. He was attracted to her as well. They were introduced on the porch at Hindman.
And I was getting quite a lot of calls from Rebecca and wondering why on earth she wanted anything to do with me. So it was both confusing and exciting.
The couple married in 2018 and continue to collaborate. Three of their themes include the land, people, and kindness.
We each, before we met each other, we were community arts organizers and artists for 20 years in Kentucky. And then when we came together, we were able to start to collaborate.
The award-winning writer talks about how she teaches poetry.
So I believe that poetry is a way of asking questions, not a way of already having answers. Right. I teach my students to approach the poem, the writing of the poem, with a question that they find overwhelming and ask the poem to teach them something they need to know about it. So it's a process of mystery.
Here's an excerpt of a poem she wrote about her mother, a child of subsistence farmers in Perry County.
And it's asking questions about what living that close to the land teaches us, you know, in ways that are not pastoral, that are very difficult, but important. It's a portrait of my mom, basically. And the poem is called, My Mother Told Us Not to Have Children. My mother told us not to have children. She'd say, never have a child you don't want. Then she'd say, of course I wanted you. Once you were here. She's not cruel, just practical. Like a kitchen knife. Still, the blade. And care.
For now, this couple will continue making a difference with their work. Rebecca Gale says they've both had a chance to be mentored and they'd like to pass it on.
Well, I think that we both came up in the Kentucky tradition of arts, which is to say, we learned from the people who came before us. We learned from the masters and the traditions that we practice. I practice writing, he practices music. You know, he studied under George Gibson, he studied under Rich Kirby, he studied under the master musicians in his community. I studied under Wendell Berry, Gurney Norman, James Baker Hall. I studied under the master musicians in my neighborhood, so to speak. And what occurred to us in recent years is that we are now the ones who need to be around to teach in this tradition where community matters most. And that's what we're trying to do.
Friday night, it's down to the dance hall. The neighbors come from all around. Children laughing and playing, folks gathered in the kitchen, all a part of that mountain sound. Hear the banjo ring, watch them jump up from their seats, join hands and start circling right. Got a fist full of love and there's glory up above, so hold on to each other tight.
In Lexington, I'm Sherry Lawson.
Hold on to each other tight.
We'll take a pause now so you can hear how to support WEKU's mission to deliver quality public radio news and information to our region. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
We have a history of significant health issues here in Kentucky, long-standing challenges from heart disease, cancer, diabetes, and more recently, COVID-19. Although all are serious, heart disease has for years slightly exceeded cancer as the state's number one killer. And as we hear from WEKU's Stu Johnson, treating heart disease has undergone important changes over the decades.
Lexington resident Linda Carnes says four generations of women in her mother's family died prior to age 65 of cardiac arrest. She's been diagnosed with long QT syndrome, a heart rhythm condition that can cause fast, chaotic heartbeats, and broken heart syndrome, a condition often brought on by stressful situations and extreme emotions. Carnes was in to see her cardiologist a few weeks ago.
He said, you know, lots of people, when they get these diagnoses, you know, kind of just sit down and give up, but you can't. I mean, there's a lot of good supportive services, a lot of good physicians who will help you, you know, keep it all on the road.
Carnes, a board member of the local American Heart Association chapter, was also found to have atrial fibrillation. With a pacemaker and medications in use, Carnes says she has advantages that her mother and previous generations didn't have. Dr. Emma Burks is Section Chief of Heart Failure Ventricular Assist Devices and Heart Transplantation at the University of Kentucky. By far, the vast majority of heart disease patients are treated with medications. But for some patients with advanced heart failure, technology plays an important role in their lives. The Ventricular Assist Device, or VAD, which assists an ailing heart to pump blood, was first created in the early 1960s. Burke says in some cases the heart can recover function through the help of the VAD.
Put the large number of patients on the ventricular assist device that are not responding to medical therapy, then maybe try the medical therapy again, try and recover them while they're on the pump. You can get some of them better. And then of those not responding, a proportion of those would then get a transplant so that you can treat more people overall.
Burke says there have been improvements made in the ventricular assist device. She says a third generation of the continuous flow pump provides an opportunity in some patients to rest the heart and improve liver and kidney function.
So initially they didn't last all that long. The pulsatile pumps really lasted 6 months or a year, but these continuous flow pumps are lasting a lot longer. They're much more durable. So they give the patient a lot longer on the pump. And they're still used as a bridge to transplant, but they're also increasingly being used as an alternative to transplant, what's called destination therapy.
Burks says there's work being done to use the continuous flow pump in a way to rest the heart enough with accompanied doses of medication to, in time, remove the pump and not have a need for transplantation. Burke says the number of hearts available for transplantation remains an issue. The Gilhart Institute professor of medicine says assumed consent is found in Spain, where heart donation is assumed unless otherwise requested. In November of 1984, a medical team at then Humana Hospital in Louisville implanted the second mechanical artificial heart. William Schrader lived for 620 days on the Jarvik 7 heart, suffering three strokes while on the pump. Serious and consistent complications put an end to that artificial heart program. There have been other artificial heart programs in this and other countries over the decades since. Then, last month in Louisville, a cardiac surgery team at UofL Health Jewish Hospital became the second group to implant a new experimental advanced total artificial heart in a southern Indiana man. The French medical device serves as a bridge to transplantation for patients with end-stage disease affecting both left and right sides of the heart. Dr. Mark Slaughter, director of the Cardiovascular Innovation Institute, led the team. While this artificial heart is aimed at extending the opportunity for transplantation, Slaughter anticipates a fully permanent artificial heart to arrive in the not-too-distant future.
So will we get there? The answer is absolutely. Is it going to be in the next year or two? You know, no. Will it maybe be in the next 5 or 10 years? I think it's quite possible. But having said that, right, I want to be very careful because we thought that right 20 years ago.
Slaughter says the hard part about developing what the future will be in treating heart disease is the extremely high cost for such technology. He says development of a left ventricular assist device takes something in the order of 15 years and $100 million. Not to be forgotten are open heart surgery and placement of stents in arteries. While much attention in recent years has focused on non-invasive procedures, Slaughter says some 400,000 open heart bypass surgeries are still done each year.
The answer is it wasn't going to go away. It still isn't going to go away. We continue to make improvements. And do we do a little bit less than we did? And the answer is yes, but it's not, dramatically less.
COVID-19 has impacted medical care in many, many ways. Dr. Slaughter says there hasn't been any scaling back of heart surgeries because of the growing number of coronavirus patients. But the chair of the Department of Cardiovascular Thoracic Surgery at U of L says there has been a slowdown in what he calls the feeding system, the cath lab, to get all pre-surgery tests done. Meanwhile, back at UK's Gill Heart and Vascular Institute, Dr. Vince Sorrell fears this period of coronavirus will cause lasting heart disease ramifications. The acting chief for the Division of Cardiovascular Medicine says changes in lifestyle, changes in physical activity, the increase in alcohol consumption, and mental stress through social isolation could all impact heart health.
I don't see an end to the impact of what's happening in 2020 and 2021. My guess is I'll retire having still dealt with the complications from COVID in these last couple of years.
Sorrell says the primary causes of heart disease in Kentucky have done a flip, where smoking was the number one factor in 1990 and body mass index number three. Now those two have changed places. He says patients are getting younger with the same amount of heart disease. Dr. Sorrell says non-invasive tests are increasing, while the need for invasive heart catheterization is decreasing. The cardiologist reports 65% of stents placed today at the Gill Institute are either urgent or emergent. With these gains in treatment in mind, Sorrell doesn't see the need for such care to decline anytime soon. Eating a more healthy diet and exercising more still remain goals for many Kentuckians. Sorrell says it may take another generation to get that message to hit home.
The only way we're going to make an impact, right, is to start the healthy living lifestyles as children so that they become teenagers and then parents, having lived through this.
And Sorrell says there are at least two other issues deserving attention and heightened awareness. He says high blood pressure during pregnancy greatly increases the chance of the mother having heart disease later in life. Sorrell says a unique challenge in rural Kentucky is the limited access to cardiac rehabilitation. We circle back now to Lindy Carnes, a Central Kentucky heart patient. She says the age-old advice of staying on top of personal health can't be denied.
You know, I think the important thing is for people to get checked regularly, to go to the doctor regularly, and, you know, at least have someone who is helping them monitor their health.
Carnes, who is this year's chair of the American Heart Association chapter's Go Red for Women campaign, says there are always stories told at annual meetings about members making their moms go to see a physician. With all the medicine and technology available, sometimes it still takes a little nudging within the family. Reporting for Eastern Standard, I'm Stu Johnson.
Jazz that's meant to be listened to. Making that possible for jazz lovers in Kentucky is the mission of the Origins Jazz Series. The series was co-founded by Chester Grundy, Richard Young, Donald Mason, and joining us now, Eli Utal-Veroff. Hello, Eli.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
I've been to many Origins shows and concerts, and I think people might be surprised to learn that there's a very vibrant jazz support community in this area. Would you agree with that assessment?
Absolutely. I was searching for that same feeling of what we would call in the jazz world the hang, that community experience of seeing the music. When I moved to Lexington about 6 years ago, and it was a little bit surprising. There were so many jazz lovers and so many musicians, and there wasn't necessarily one central gathering point. And so that's really been the mission of Origins more than anything, is creating that place and that environment for everyone to come together.
Where are your primary venues?
We've done most of our concerts at TD's Lounge or at the Lyric Theater. And then with a couple of sort of satellite locations, the Downtown Arts Center and the Lexington Children's Theater. And then we're never afraid to try out a new space and turn what isn't necessarily a concert venue into a concert venue. But this season, we have a really cool new development. We have a partnership with Space 249, which is a co-working space that also just has a beautiful room that lends itself really well to being turned into one of our on-the-fly venues.
And am I correct that they've even added a piano?
Yeah, we collaborated on that. We were really lucky. There's a local church music director who's a jazz vibraphonist himself who was able to make a great partnership. They had a piano that wasn't really suiting their needs for what they needed from it, and we needed a piano. So yeah, we were able to buy a baby grand, and it seems like maybe an insignificant thing, but having an instrument like that that is dependable, that is there when you need it, is actually a bit of a rarity. Mm-hmm. Here in Lexington, at least for venues that are well suited to jazz, because there's certainly great venues that are probably too many seats to create that intimate environment that we are looking for.
Well, tell us about your lineup for coming shows this season.
Coming up, we have Charlie Ballantyne, who's a fantastic guitarist out of Indianapolis, in the Bill Frisell, Julian Lage sort of vein with some crossover with country and Americana influences. And he's doing a concert on September 24th, doing the music of Thelonious Monk. We have local pianist Keith McCutcheon is doing a new project inspired by Latin jazz with a quintet, and that will be our October show. We have Greg Tardy, who's a phenomenal tenor saxophonist who spent many, many years in New York City playing with some of the greatest out there, played with Elvin Jones, who is John Coltrane's drummer, and played with Jazz at Lincoln Center and Bill Frisell, and now makes his living at teaching at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville. And so he's one of our he's both a national talent, but also right in our region. And then lastly, we're featuring Megan Pund, who's a phenomenal clarinetist who was featured on the Duke Ellington Nutcracker concert that we did in December of 2019, leading her own quintet, and that'll be our December show.
So fans that want to know more, they want to even help the Origins Jazz Series, where can they go online to learn more?
The easiest way to find us is at originsjazz.org. And from there, you can find information about the season and our latest COVID protocols for our concerts, and then also links to tickets when we have concerts and other ways to support.
That's Origins Jazz Series co-founder Eli Utal-Veroff, and we thank you so much, Eli. Good luck with the season.
Thank you.
Still ahead, Samantha Morrill with the latest on preparations to receive Afghan refugees, and Wendy Barnett on 20 years of Red Barn Radio. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. We've been keeping in touch with Kentucky Refugee Ministry's Derek Feldman on plans to receive and accommodate refugees from Afghanistan. WEKU's Samantha Morrill has the latest.
Derek, thank you so much for giving us your time today.
Thank you.
So last time you spoke with Eastern Standard, you mentioned some refugees that were supposed to come to Kentucky. KRM was ready to receive them, then it was canceled. What's happened to those people since then? Have any of them made it to Kentucky?
There was one family that were SIVs, their special immigrant visas from Afghanistan, and they were able to come. They are now here in Lexington, and we're very happy that they are here and safe. They absolutely were rattled, but they are okay and safe, and we're happy to welcome them here. There are more that have not come yet, and there are a number of evacuees that are now being processed at U.S. military bases that then our understanding is that they will then be offered, resettlement type services out at other places, Lexington being one of those places.
So when they arrive in Lexington, say, do you already have a home and apartment set up for them, or is there like an interim they've got to like kind of wait for that to get set up?
Yeah, so usually for refugees who are arriving from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, for example, or Syria or the Ukraine, we know about them ahead of time, usually about 2 weeks, sometimes as much as 4 weeks in advance. Mm-hmm. And yes, we usually are able to find an apartment or a home. We take donated furniture from the community and volunteers from the community help set up those apartments and homes with furniture and make it a home and ready to welcome them. The Afghan humanitarian parolees who, we anticipate receiving sometime over the next 3 months or so, we're told that we probably will not have that kind of heads up. Although we generally know that they will be coming, of any particular family that's coming, we may only have 24 or 48 hours notice.
Wow.
So that does create, some logistical issues, as you can imagine. We are in need of real estate owners, apartment complexes that are able and willing to rent to us if it's, sometimes just temporary housing if needed while we wait for an apartment to become available, those kinds of things. All of those things are needed right now, in addition to donation of household items and that kind of thing.
I was going to ask you where in the process of resettlement were the majority of these refugees, but if you're getting 24, 48 hours notice and you're looking out 3 months ahead, I mean, have the majority of these refugees even made it to central Kentucky?
Right. So we have not received any of the, so like I said, we did receive one family from Afghanistan who were SIVs, who were already in the system, and who were able to be evacuated, and so we were able to receive them already. The rest of, evacuees, which we anticipate about 125 coming to Lexington, are there at military bases. We have a staff member, actually, that was sent to one of the military bases to help with that processing. They go through all kinds of background checks and all kinds of processing that you can, health checks, screenings that they go to, and then are offered, where they would like to come. And so we anticipate about 125 people over the next 3 months. We have not received any of those parolees yet, but okay. We anticipate that we will here soon.
Are you hearing anything about relatives of Afghan refugees who worked for the U.S. and NATO who've not made it out of the country?
Yes, family, of course, family members who are still concerned and worried about other family members that did not make it out. Absolutely. We have heard from people who are already here that they are concerned about their family members.
Is there any hope that their family members will be able to escape the country?
It is extremely scary for those family members, but I think there's always hope.
When we heard from you in August, you mentioned some of the ways people in central and eastern Kentucky could help this process. Welcoming, of course, we've talked again about donating supplies. One of the things you mentioned was ESL tutoring. Do you have to have any special qualifications or trainings to do that kind of tutoring and have people contacted you about it?
Yeah, we do offer ESL tutoring, and there is a training involved in it. You don't have to have it up front. You don't have to have any, you know, ESL tutoring training ahead of time. The first step is to become a volunteer and then just express that ESL tutoring is what you're interested in. We have a training as part of that and, you know, a nice book, whether it's, you know, English to Swahili or Arabic or any number of languages that people do. And just, you know, getting to know clients and making that connection is extremely important. Just practicing English conversation and then, you know, actually as a tutor for kids or sometimes for parents who can't, you know, leave, can't go to work because they have young children at home and they might not be able to come to a class. Those kinds of ESL tutoring is really wonderful.
Do you see a lot of friendships come out of that kind of relationship, this tutoring? Does it ever evolve into a lasting friendship?
Yeah, you can make, you know, personal connections. It is a professional, you know, relationship in terms of volunteer and volunteer-y, but there are, you know, definitely significant relationships that that last for a long time. And it's important, that part of welcoming and that part of real connection here. Refugees have, you know, lost their homes. They've lost all their things, their documents, sometimes people in their lives. And to have that real connection with someone here from Kentucky who has real connections with other people around town and that kind of thing is extremely important to really being integrated into our welcoming community.
Oh, yeah. Derek Feldman, Community Engagement Coordinator for Kentucky Refugee Ministries, thank you so much for your time today, and I'm sure we'll be contacting you for another update in the months to come.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk to people about this.
One of our locally produced programs is entering its third decade this year. Here's WEKU's Wendy Barnett in conversation with Red Barn Radio's Ed Commons.
Welcome to the program, Ed.
Thanks. It's wonderful to be here.
So nice to have your voice added into the many other voices you hear on Eastern Standard. But we brought you here because Red Barn Radio has recently started its 20th season. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's quite a surprise, one might say. When you start out doing a project, which we did basically 20 years ago, somehow you don't think about the future and you get caught up in the week-to-week production, as you know what it's about, and Tom as well. And all of a sudden you look at a calendar and, my gosh, time has gone.
Well, let's look back to that day when you started. Did you think that you would be doing this 20 years from then?
No. The program began when my founding partner, Marilyn Myers, and I were working on the Music Museum and Hall of Fame in Renfrew Valley. Our first recordings were done there in the Little Red Barn, a building that I don't think exists anymore, hence obviously the name. Mm-hmm. And those shows really never got to air. We moved to Lexington and started at the Phoenix Ballroom, which is now a space above the Hopcat, and we were there for two seasons. Basically, the show was old time and bluegrass, all recorded sort of live-ish in this room with an audience, and everyone packed together, and then it was edited, as we do now, into a final format. During that Phoenix Ballroom time, we got our first station on board, which was the station then at Georgetown College, WRVG, that in this region was revered for the kind of programming that it did.
So looking back to then, starting as an old-timey radio, how has that progressed and changed to what we hear in the 20th season?
Well, we had an artist called John Simpson come in who wanted to be on the show. We now know him as Sturgill. Mm-hmm. And he assured us that he was going to do sort of a laid-back acoustic version. Well, they came in with the drum kit and brought an audience, and it really changed how we looked at the music of the region.
and music that we could handle. So over the years, it went from that old time and bluegrass and then morphed, as it would, into something that's more regional. And as our new slogan that we've had for some years, roots music, Southern style, which allows us not only to pay homage to this region and Appalachia, but go beyond it, as we're getting a lot of artists from Virginia, North Carolina, and obviously northbound into Ohio and Indiana as well.
Aside from this being the 20th season with all new bands, and especially since you've expanded your theme, you've got more variety to choose from.
Right. I think it's changing our demographic. A lot of the old time and bluegrass really attracted a more mature crowd, if that's a polite way of saying it. And with the new format and bands that are coming in with a lot more energy, we're trying to appeal a bit to a younger generation, people that are discovering what we do. Our show, unlike others out there, does not generally have well-known people on it. Yeah, we have a few, but generally these are bands, the best music you've never heard of is kind of how it works. And we are being more and more discovered because of our YouTube channel. We live stream since COVID hit, and we were closed for 10 weeks a year and a half ago, whenever that was. We really started concentrating on our live stream, which has really picked up and really moved us forward a great deal. And also individual videos on our YouTube channel, which has millions of views. We're finding that a lot of musicians are discovering our music, and a lot of audience, obviously. As an example, we had a group on not long ago out of Colorado called Red Iron Push. They said, how did you discover us? They followed an artist out of Nashville, brilliant young woman who's going to be back later in the season, called Sierra Farrell. And they saw the thing that we had put up on YouTube of her performance with us, and they drove in 17 hours to be with us. So it was a great show. So we were joking off, you know, off stage and stuff, you know, how did you hear from us and who listens to us? And he said, you would be amazed the amount of cowboys out there with cell phones in the field that are aware of Red Barn. And I'm going, that's a really strange image, people, but I love it.
I love it. That's wonderful.
We've had two other instances about an audience, and you know this because you work in a bunker with no outer world, and you think nobody's out there, or you assume they are.
But, right.
We got an email maybe a year or so ago from a gentleman in Birmingham, England, who said that every Wednesday night he and his family stay up to watch the live stream, and I was just blown away. What are your kids doing up at one in the morning? No, but again, that personal thing. And then this last year, we received a handwritten card thanking Red Barn for what we do and the great music. And it was from Lithuania. And you're going, someone took the time to write a card through International Post to thank us. And it's those moments that mean a great deal to me in producing the show. It's really remarkable that we're still gaining traction, we're gaining fans, and I think particularly the mission of letting musicians that really are in a position where they are ready for their career to step forward, and they're reaching out to us to give them that jump start. As an example, going back in the past, we had a band called Highwall that morphed into the Wooks, and they had a front singer come on years ago. His name was Tyler Childers. He was with us two other times, and his recordings that he made with us were his first professional records and recordings that were out there. And we're terribly proud of that, that we had a hand and he had a hand in us. It's sort of a sharing event.
You can watch Red Barn Radio's live stream Wednesday night, 7 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. You can listen to the Red Barn Radio Hour each Saturday evening at 9 o'clock. And Ed, where else can people find Red Barn Radio?
Well, the easiest way to to find that is go to redvineradio.com and listen. But we're on Spotify and iTunes. You can find us, our videos on YouTube. You just need to Google us a little bit. We're all over the place.
Ed, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's always good to speak with Wendy. We have a great relationship. She does a lot for Red Barn and has through the years through what she's done at the station. It's great.
Thank you, Ed.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. Eastern Standard is on air and online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.